Hey there, Rob Wolf, broadcasting, podcasting, something like that from Santa Fe, episode 79 of the Paleo Solution podcast. Greg Everett, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. A little early morning podcast action, and I got my high rev coffee, which is double the caffeine as regular coffee.
Is that the same stuff that Ruttman was pimping there for?
No, that was like Skullcracker or something crazy like that. Well, yeah. Oh, it's like or shock,
yeah, something like that. Aftershock or something like that. Yeah,
that's still one of my favorite stories of all time. Was when the Rutt stayed at Coach Bergner's house and he slept in the little outside cabana thing. And he said, "You know, I think that the rooster next door is getting into Leslie's compost bin and eating the coffee because that kid was keeping me awake all night." And then he said something like, have you ever seen Bergner? When he puts coffee into his coffee maker, he doesn't use a spoon. He uses an ice cream scooper. It's like, I've had a low-grade headache all weekend.
And Rutt does some pretty serious coffee consumption on his own. Like, when Nikki and I stayed with him, we put about 30,000 miles on his Jura. So that dude knows his way around some caffeine overload. But Bergner may indeed live forever because of his caffeine intake.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's see here. What's cooking? We've got some Paleo Solution seminars coming up here. What do we have? We have one in Vancouver on July 9th. We have another one in Boston, Boston, Massachusetts on August 20th. I forget the exact date for the Ancestral Health Symposium, but that's going to be at UCLA. I think that's like August 4th or something, but check stuff out on that. We have some new folks doing consulting, Amy Kubel, so this big hairy dude, Greg Everett, and Glenn Cordoza. So if folks are looking for consulting, check out the new consulting page. Greg, what's the status on the DVD?
Actually finished filming. Thank God. If I have to shoot another frame of that DVD, I'm going to straight up murder somebody. Fortunately, I was using Two Take Steve for this one instead of my lovely wife, Amy, who prefers to not really listen to what I'm asking her to do and kind of do what she thinks I want her to do, which means we have to shoot it about 1,000 times.
So it's more like an interpretive dance than it is an instructional thing.
Yes,
when Amy's
exactly
on there.
And so cool. Steve knows that I'll punch him in his dirty little mouth if he doesn't do what I ask him to, and he gets it done.
Well, and you always have the carrot with Stave Payne of simply offering in Jack-in-the-Box credits. So,
seriously.
That'll roust him pretty good. So, projected timeline on that, or are we still just...
The editing is actually... I've been editing as we film, so it's getting pretty close. So I'm hoping to have a quick turnaround here. And let's see, what is it? The first week of May. So I'm hoping by the end of May I have that thing in hand.
So one DVD, two DVDs, what's the size on that thing?
I actually don't know. It may be one or two DVDs. Or we may even get really jiggy and do a double-sided DVD.
Mm, crazy talk.
And that's for being environmentally friendly.
There you go. Cool. I like it.
Sweet, dude.
So, you know, we've had a number of emails pop in for the blog, and then also we've had this topic... about toe position, basically, in the squat. And this was a topic that was pretty hot on the NorCal strength and conditioning kind of back end, where the trainers discussed different elements of, like, nutrition and biomechanics, or whether or not one of their clients might be borderline and insane under different circumstances. And so I shot an email to Greg because he's just super sharp on all this stuff. And so, Greg, I mean, the basic deal, I mean, historically... we've generally had this, you know, anywhere from like slightly to, you know, being about 10 to 15 degrees toed out to maybe about 30 degrees toed out kind of position for squatting. But there definitely seems to be some scenarios where the toes forward squat would have some efficacy. But like with everything, I like to couch this stuff in terms of, you know, who are you? What are you trying to do? So what's going on with all this stuff? And then you wrote an article for the performance menu also.
Yeah, well, it's actually just a free article on the website.
Okay.
So you can find that on the site. It's the current article out there right now. You can see it on the front page. But in any case, go to the article section, and it'll be one of the newest ones by the time this podcast comes out.
And we'll put a hot link in there too.
It'll be a super hot link.
Whipped with mustard and relish.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, anything I say about this topic, you got to understand that it's definitely coming from the perspective of someone who works with and essentially cares exclusively about weightlifters. So, you know, whatever I say regarding the use of squatting for other athletes, you know, take it with a grain of salt and definitely consult your local expert. But, I mean, as I kind of described in the article, there's very simple but I think important reasons that we use a toes-out position in the squat. And basically what that comes down to is that we want the joints in question to be aligned and functioning in the plane in which they're supposed to function. You know, biggest one is the knee, right? The knee is a hinge joint. It's not supposed to rotate. Ankle, you can get some rotation out of it, but it's probably not a great idea to force that kind of rotation, especially in a really kind of near maximal or maximal dorsiflexion position. And then the hips, we like the hips to move how the hips want to move, barring, of course, you know, some severe inflexibility or some wonkiness there. But so basically you end up with, like Rob said, kind of that, you know, 10 to 30 degree toe out position, which people I think will generally find fairly naturally. And that allows the hips to open, whether you're squatting to full depth or even partial depth, that's going to allow the hip to move in the plane in which it's not impeded by, you know, the femur bumping into part of the pelvis, which is both potentially painful and definitely is going to limit your range of motion. And then once you've got that hip angle, you basically just align your foot with your leg, and that makes your knee hinge. Obviously, the foot has to be under the leg. You can't put the foot way inside or outside the leg because then you're going to get rotation on the knee also. But, you know, it's really – you can reduce the issue to that right there, in my opinion. And, again, as I said too, if you're going to be doing a partial range of motion squat like parallel or above – the toe position matters less and less because the knee is, you know, not getting anywhere near full flexion. And so you're not getting that rotation as much. So for example, if you're doing, you know, a quarter squat or a half squat and you want to squat toes forward, you're probably not going to have much problems with your knees. I still wouldn't do it personally. I haven't really seen a compelling argument for it. And I feel that it's, you know, having your joints move as they're supposed to move is a fairly compelling argument against it. So, but obviously there are some situations where people are liking the toes forward thing. And Rob, you probably know more about that than I do.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, like Kelly Starrett's been talking about it a fair amount. Rafael Ruiz, who super sharp strength and conditioning coach, he travels with John Wellborn with the CrossFit football scene. And Roth really likes that toes forward position, mainly because out of like running, jumping, kicking, you know, in general, that toes forward position generates the biomechanics that are consistent with those movements. You know, and I think to some degree what Kelly has been saying, and I don't want to misquote him on this, but he's been seeing a situation in which folks are defaulting, say like when they get ready to sprint or they get ready to jump, their default movement pattern is actually this toed out position instead of a toes forward position. So you're seeing people sprint, jump, decelerate off of a box jump landing or off of a broad jump landing in a toed out position. And my gut sense on this is, to some degree, this is a product of people doing a ton of CrossFit-esque volume type training. And what you end up finding is a kind of an optimized position, which typically is some sort of a toed out spot, but you end up kettlebell swinging, sumo deadlift, high pulling, air squatting, and you know, you're doing hundreds, if not thousands, of reps per month in this toed out position. And so you end up developing a very strong motor pattern that reinforces that. And virtually none of the training is occurring with a toes forward position. And so this is, in my opinion, again, this somewhat of a problem of looking at the, you know, chasing a sportive element related to conditioning, you know, the sport of fitness kind of gig, it's great. It's super fun. Like I'm super impressed with everybody competing in the regional, you know, scene and all that, all the online stuff. Like it's a very impressive scenario. But I think that there's some stuff to kind of look in a little bit deeper on this, in that you might consider doing some of these movements in what might be suboptimal for turning your best Fran time or your best kettlebell swing turnover, but there might be some developmental elements to that that actually make you more orthopedically sound, or that keep your biomechanics for running, sprinting, jumping a little bit more consistent. And I think to some degree that, you know, that's what I've heard Raphael articulate. Maybe we can get him on the show at some future point. But that's kind of my understanding on that stuff. And so it's this thing again, like, and part of what prompted this was some of our trainers asking some questions about, you know, well, why would you want to do this versus the squat that we've been teaching in the gym, which is a toed out position sufficient to allow people to get that full range of movement in the squat. And large, you know, our population is largely just people wanting to be fit and in shape and strong and lean. And eventually some of them get excited about their max lifts, like in the squat and the deadlift and stuff like that. But generally people are in there for just, you know, getting a good workout and having fun and having community. But we've never had problems with like ankle injuries, knee injuries with squatting this way. And we typically are playing to the orthopedic limitations that people have. And we'll keep an eye on bar placement so that we can keep the center of mass of the individual over the base of their foot and all that sort of jive. And so some people end up with a higher bar position and more upright, and some people a lower bar position. But, you know, we typically have had people kettlebell swing with the toes more forward and do some other movements with the toes forward to kind of round out that offering. And then we do a fair amount of prowler pushing, sled dragging, and stuff like that, which also is reinforcing that toes forward, glute, hamstring, hip extension kind of movement pattern. And then also we've for a long time been defaulting to a lot of other things for the metabolic conditioning, like bear crawls, crab crawls, sandbag cleans, you know, stuff like that. So we really try to diversify our pool of movements, even if they're difficult to quantify, just so that we're not reinforcing a ton of orthopedic problems or neuromuscular patterns that may have some problems down the road. So
yeah, see, that brings up a lot of different issues in my mind. And the first one that springs to mind is that CrossFit is probably not the best way to prepare a competitive athlete. And I know I'm probably going to get some nasty emails about that, but that's the way I feel about it. There's not enough plan. Like you said, you're getting this huge volume of training, which is, it's not controlled enough, it's not planned enough, and so you end up with these unintentional consequences, like, hey, this guy walks around duck-footed by accident now because his hip, you know, his external rotators are tight or whatever. But you know, you look at squatting in a strength and conditioning situation, and that's a pretty small number of repetitions over a given period of time. And you compare that to the number of repetitions, the number of foot strikes or whatever from plyo exercises, sprinting, cutting drills, agility drills, jumping, landing, all that stuff. And it just pales in comparison. And if those athletes are being taught proper mechanics, they're practicing proper mechanics with those more sport-specific skills, there's no reason in my mind that doing a few loaded squats with the toes out position is going to have any effect on that. The only potential issue I see there is with regard to flexibility and strength. But you should be taking care of flexibility anyway. That should be a given. That shouldn't even have to be brought up. But second, in addition to bilateral squatting, most ground-based athletes should be doing a lot of unilateral leg work, in which case it's going to be a toes forward position. And not only are you working on that toes forward position, but now you're talking about kind of developing the hip and ankle stability that's required to maintain that toes forward position in those skills, in those movements. So I just, you know, I really, again, just don't see any reason to squat toes forward. And someone actually in the comments, I'm looking at the comments in my article that was posted, and I guess Kelly brought up Gray Cook and functional movement screen and stuff like that, and how the test squat is toes forward. And so this guy says, you know, I'm confused because Gray Cook said this in an interview. And this is a quote of Gray Cook. This is also the reason why we teach the loaded squat the way great lifters squat. The test squat and the loaded squat are two different patterns needed for two different skills. So, you know, even Gray Cook, the guy who's testing, you know, mobility, balance, whatever, with a toes forward squat, is telling people to, when, you know, when they train the squat, they're training toes out because that's what produces the optimal squat. And so I just, you know, I just don't see a whole lot of overlap there, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, I just see this a lot. Like, it's great that people, you know, that they think about this stuff, that they ruminate on it. I see a lot of neophyte coaches, though, like, just anything new that pops up, they assume that everything that they've been doing was wrong or stupid or whatever. And I mean, there's certainly occasionally convention may be wrong. People may be doing it because it's goofy. But when you start getting into the realm of athletic training, particularly if you're making a living doing it and you're legitimately training athletes, like, you know, people who compete in a sport and they get paid, or they're, you know, there's some sort of like pretty high stakes to it. This is different than, you know, fitness training. Usually these conventions are kind of honed through this blacksmithing and busting off everything that doesn't work super well. And you end up with some stuff that, depending on where you are, it ends up looking fairly similar, whether you're looking at Poliquin type stuff or, you know, West Side Barbell type stuff. There's some variation to it, but there's probably more similarity than not. So I don't even want to say caution, but I would encourage people to really think this stuff through. And this is the same stuff that I try to do with the food. You know, people want one answer. You know, is carbohydrates post-workout good or bad? Go. And it's like, well, it depends. You know, it just depends. And so this is the same deal with the squatting position and with a ton of other training issues. And I just see, and I've experienced, you know, of late, this tendency for neophyte trainers and coaches to really want to take everything that is kind of put forward to them. You know, it's like, hey, this is our system, this is the way we tackle stuff. And at the drop of a hat, they want to abandon everything that they've been playing with and adopt this completely alternate view without really understanding one way or the other why they're doing either one, without any kind of deep level on it. So I guess this is just another one of those things. You know, different situations dictate different methodology, different approaches, and, you know, obviously different people have different biomechanics. So this is, again, where that challenge of fitness or training for the masses is made very, very difficult if you're going to get in and start making some really specific prescriptive things about, like, you absolutely should squat toes forward, or you absolutely should, you know, be toed out or whatever. You need to think about the whole programming package, the whole periodization, orthopedic issues and limitations of the individual. It gets a little bit more complex than simply, you know, this is your patent answer to it. There needs to be a little bit of thought about why you're doing any of that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think it would be interesting to get Raphael on here. And also, I'm going to try to get in touch with like Joe Ken and Dwayne Carlisle and see if I can get them on here for a minute, because I'd be curious to hear their thoughts on that stuff too.
Well, I'm sure that we could get Gray on here also. He's been doing some work with Erwan LaCour with MoveNat, and so there's some good relationship there. And it'd be great to get Kelly Starrett on here, but that would get him fired, so I guess that won't happen. So,
all
right. So next topic.
Yes. All right. So Grace says, looking for help. Seems my squat cannot improve with the tightness of my quads/hamstrings as well as the tilt. Pelvic tilt was the title of the email. So that's the tilt. I use a belt when squatting, but with everything else, the tilt and tightness never seems to get any better. What exercises and stretches are best with having a pelvic tilt as well as with an extremely tight right hamstring quad? I think that's a magnesium deficiency.
At the very least.
Or maybe it's phosphorus. I forget which side. Will these help get rid of the pelvic tilt and relieve the tightness? How do you get rid of the pelvic tilt? Rob, you want to lead off with this one? I want to say, first of all, don't entirely get rid of the pelvic tilt. It's kind of right. Hot.
It is kind of hot. There's a little badunkadunkaliciousness potentially there. So first off,
you don't want to be a flat butt, Grace.
You don't want to be, which is exactly where I was going with this. I'm assuming that Grace is talking about an anterior pelvic tilt. We actually have some people who end up with a posterior pelvic tilt.
That's weird.
In which they effectively look like they have no fanny. And so I'm assuming an anterior pelvic tilt where the butt's kind of rocked out and kicked forward.
Hairdresser back.
Hairdresser back. Yeah, totally, totally. Lots of funny stories with that. But
oh, boy.
Back to the early days of NorCal. So, there's kind of an interesting feature of the anterior pelvic tilt where you get a little bit of preload on the hamstrings. It's actually advantageous for a lot of athletic endeavors. You just don't want it to go too much. And if it's limiting the ability to fully squat, this is where some sort of, it's interesting. We're working with Erwan LaCour, helping him develop some infrastructure within the MoveNat and developing all the curriculum for his certification. And part of what we're talking about right now is how do you tackle assessing someone and their movement quality? And generally, I still kind of default back, 80 or 90% to can you squat and press and pull, horizontal pulling, horizontal pressing, et cetera, et cetera. I kind of default 90% of my stuff to just these large, gross movement patterns. And then if there's something squirrely with it or something uncomfortable, then we start getting in and doing some sort of like a Gray Cook, like functional movement screen, or there's a load of different modalities out there for assessing, say, like hamstring versus quad tightness or lateral hip rotator versus hip internal rotators. And so internal versus external rotators, sorry. So this is where I would want to do some assessment on, what type of hip flexor issues we've got going on or mobility. Does it look like there's some psoas involvement? Are the glutes firing under kind of standard operating procedures? You would assume that they are because of that anterior pelvic tilt. But it's possible we've got so much anterior pelvic tilt that the glutes are now a little bit dead and they're not working to pull the pelvis back down into a little bit of a posterior position. So the prescriptive element to this, the death stretch is a huge one. We've talked about that in the performance menu a ton. Lateral rotator opening, kind of like pigeon pose, doing some hip capsule mobility, which again, Kelly Starrett has done some great stuff illustrating some manual methods for opening the hip capsule. But Greg, what's your thoughts on that? I mean, you need a little bit of assessment before you can just put out a blanket statement on that. But those are kind of the prime movers at the hip, and so that's the primary places that you're going to look for a problem.
Yeah, and that's the thing too. I think to give Kelly Starrett credit on this, he's made the point I think a number of times. And I think I made this point in my book too, is that you really don't need to know what muscles are tight or what exactly you're stretching. You need to focus on movement and position and just approach it that way. But in any case, I think basically like Rob said, you probably have some psoas stuff going on and you probably don't really have a whole lot of TVA activation or strength. And then possibly some saggy glutes that aren't firing and rotating that pelvis back. So it could be a number of things, and it could be a combination of flexibility limitations or strength limitations or both. But in any case, you probably want to take kind of a real shotgun approach to it, and instead of spending 6 months trying to determine exactly which muscle is the problem, just hit everything, and it's going to work. And as you kind of make some progress with it, you're probably going to figure out, a little bit more accurately what the biggest offender was. So, yeah, that death stretch, which if you're not familiar with, is basically a lunge with your foot elevated so you can close the knee and open the hip all the way. So that really hits that rectus femoris there. It's the quad that crosses the knee and the hip both. That thing gets notoriously tight with weightlifters too. And so you see a lot of hairdresser back with weightlifters. And that thing, I remember when I first met Amy, she had really bad hyperlordosis. And I looked at her and I was like, you have got to take care of this. You're going to blow your back out. And, you know, 2 or 3 years later, yeah, she fractured her back. But, and you know, I was hitting her, that kind of origin, that rectus femoris, like, you got to loosen this up. You feel how tight this is. And she's like, I thought that was a bone. It's like, well, it probably is now. Like, it shouldn't feel like a bone. But, so yeah, that death stretch, but it, rather than just facing straight ahead, rotate towards that, the front leg away from the back leg that you're stretching. That'll hit that even more, but make sure you keep your abs tight and your glutes tight while you're doing that stretch too. So a lot of times what will happen is if you relax the abs, relax the glutes, you just hyperextend your lower back and you actually lose some of that hip flexor stretch on there. So a lot of times if you really focus on tightening that, all of a sudden you'll feel that really – it feels like something in your guts is stretching. That's your psoas up in there getting teed off on. Like Rob said, do some glute activation stuff. The Spider-Man stretch I really like. That one's just kind of a good general kind of hip opening deal. And because I think a lot of times too people get pissed off at their hamstrings, and I think – you know, sometimes it's coming more out of the adductors than the hamstrings. Mm-hmm. And so that Spider-Man stretch will kind of hit both. And so again, with that one, you got to make sure you're not just rounding over and trying to like reach your head to the floor. You really want to try to move your whole torso down, and it should essentially feel like someone's trying to dislocate your hip, but stopping a little bit short of that, of course. And then, doing a lot of plank stuff, but really focusing on kind of that hollow position. And anyone who knows me knows that I hate the idea of hollowing the abs, but this is the one exception. And I'll give Joe Ken props again for this, for really pointing this out to me. And he's kind of the same way. So, you know, this is the one time I want you to think about drawing your belly in, is in that plank. So get some good TVA activation. Because a lot of times, you know, that lower cross syndrome, it's, you know, there's just no TVA activation at all.
And that's a transversus abdominis.
Yes, so, the transvestite that abdominis.
The cross-dressing abdominis. This is what's pulling the belly button in. And, you know, it's interesting. In gymnastics, that hollow position is all over the place, but gymnasts are not concerned with loading the spine through, you know, upper body through the lower body.
Right.
And so this is another one of those examples where there's rules all over the place, and then there's almost as many exceptions to the rules.
Yeah, and the one last stretch I would try is what we call here the Russian baby maker. And that is probably most of you listening are familiar with kind of like the goblet squat or Mark Ripito's little stretch there where you wedge your elbows between your knees and spread your knees. This is kind of similar to that, but instead what I have people do is take their feet out a little bit wider than their normal squat stance, sometimes considerably wider. And rather than put their elbows between their knees, you get your elbows in as deep in towards your groin as you can, kind of hands on top of your feet. And so rather than trying to spread the distal ends of your femur, you're trying to spread the proximal ends of your femur. In other words, you're basically trying to rip your pelvis in half. And so you can really kind of wedge in there and open up those hips that way. And that's been really helpful for a lot of people, and it has a kick-ass name too. So we don't have nearly Russian enough time for me to explain the origin of that name, but trust me, it's funny.
Perfect. Cool. So, yeah, good stuff on that. I'll just let that one lie.
And, oh, yeah, one last thing I want to reiterate what Rob said, too, is that a little bit of pelvic tilt is probably good for you in terms of athletic performance. You know, if you look at the postural specialist, you know, say like Esther Gokhale or something like that, you know, she's looking to actually reduce what has, as far as she's concerned, you know, become considered normal spinal curvature, which she considers to be a little bit excessive. But I think that, you know, as Rob said, you kind of get a better athletic position with some degree of anterior pelvic tilt. So, let's talk about tendonitis / tendinosis.
Cool.
Charlie says, "Hey guys, thank you so much for your efforts. You guys have made a huge difference in my family getting healthy. My question is as follows. Are there any dietary or supplementary changes that someone can implement to reverse severe tendonitis / tendinosis? Just finishing up a college football career and really struggling with knee tendinosis. Can't squat and can barely jump anymore. It's really limiting me in my quest to recover and become healthy. Thanks so much."
So, I mean, you know, nutrition-wise, just that standard anti-inflammatory paleo shtick, you know, reduce glycemic load, take care of gut health, vitamin D, do some fish oil, you know, all of that standard stuff. If we reduce systemic inflammation, then the likelihood of tendonitis, tendinosis should decrease. And then from there, I would really start looking. It seems like we're kind of in an orthopedic, you know, vein today. But then I would start looking at range of movement stuff, you know, like do we have some super tight TFL? Do we have some super tight hip flexor that is leading into some tracking issues? People underestimate the severity that tight musculature can impose on connective tissue. But if you think about it being like rigging that holds up a bridge or holds up like a tent or something like that, there's kind of an optimal degree of tension in that connective tissue. And if you start tightening it up beyond that, then it will actually start degrading and breaking down the connective tissue. And also it causes the rest of the orthopedic, you know, structures to not track in the proper way. So I, you know, the nutrition, you need to address that. You need to make sure you're sleeping, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Then getting in and looking at soft tissue work, foam rolling, stretching, you know, getting a tennis or lacrosse ball in there, trying to break up scar tissue. That all needs to be addressed also. And then on the kind of quasi-pharmaceutical side of things, there's this product from New Chapter called Zyflamend, and they have an AM and a PM version. The PM has like some hops and some other stuff that actually kind of knocks you out a little bit. But I see that as being very, very acute, necessary for only acute issues, and we shouldn't have chronic issues. I mean, unless you're a high-level athlete that's getting paid to beat yourself up, I just can't see the point of constantly having some sort of tendonitis, tendinosis going on and not addressing the orthopedic issues and the nutritional characteristics that should help that.
Yeah.
So that's my thought.
Yeah, I think all that, I second all that. And then also, in terms of supplements, get a good glucosamine/chondroitin/MSM supplement. That pretty much across the board, I mean, like even orthopedic surgeons admit that stuff helps, which is unusual for them to say that anything other than surgery is going to help. And then ice massage that thing, that patellar tendon, and then try some like cross friction massage, like kick your thumb in there and kind of massage back and forth kind of against the grain. Do that for a couple minutes before you ice. And then, like Rob said, take care of the soft tissue stuff, because especially if you're not playing anymore and it sounds like you're not squatting and jumping anymore, there shouldn't be anything exacerbating this or prolonging it. It should be clearing up. So this stuff really should just speed the healing. There really shouldn't be anything that's causing this to continue. So there's no reason this stuff shouldn't clear up relatively quickly. So if it's not, there's obviously something weird going on.
Yeah. Yeah. So give that stuff a crack and let us know how it goes. See if what we made up is effective.
Yes. Or you could just talk to a professional.
Instead of the two slappies on the Paleo Solution podcast.
Oh, boy. All right. These are a lot of training-related questions, but that's okay because no one likes nutrition. I mean, come on.
Food is goofy.
Nick says, "Hey, Rob and Greg, started Olympic lifting recently, and my coach mentioned that I have stupidly long legs, primarily tib-fib, and it affects the bottom position in receiving the clean and snatch. What are your thoughts on this in regards to receiving clean /snatch in the bottom? Am I doomed from properly receiving the bar, or will stretching/mobilizing do the trick? Thanks, guys."
So this is definitely not my – I am a mediocre O-lifting coach at best. The two things that pop into my head are, do you want to be a competitive lifter, or are you using this as a means to just have fun or develop some other athletic attributes? and then somewhat associated with that, potentially using the split variant for the lifts. But Greg's the total expert on this. So
I think, honestly, I mean, yeah, long legs definitely are going to make your life a little bit tougher with regard to weightlifting. That's just kind of the nature of the sport. It favors people with shorter levers. But if you're going to have long legs, you're better off having a longer tib-fib than femur. Because the femur is where you're really going to lose your leverage advantage. So the longer tib-fib kind of might make things screwy a little bit. You probably will end up with a much narrower foot position. And this actually goes back to the first thing we talked about, is kind of get that knee and ankle aligned. But yeah, ankle flexibility, hip flexibility, upper back flexibility, all that stuff is going to help you get a decent bottom position. I don't think there's any reason you can't. I've got a guy in here who's 6'4", long ass legs, and I mean, he squats ass to the platform, and he squats a lot. So there's really no reason you can't do it. Will it be fun working on that flexibility? No, it's really boring. Usually it takes a long time. But if you really want to progress in this stuff, you're going to have to just knuckle down and do it. And you need to be consistent with it, be aggressive with it. And, you know, play with that foot position a little bit too. You may find that towing in a little less, a little more, taking the stance in or out somewhat, it will help. So mess around with it. And again, just be glad your femurs aren't the things that are stupidly long. And, you know, make sure you're wearing weightlifting shoes too. I shouldn't even have to say that. If you have a weightlifting coach, I'm sure he's telling you to wear weightlifting shoes. So that may be superfluous, but do it. No toe shoes.
So, you know, on the stretching, I think, you know, figuring out a stretch that you could do throughout the day and maybe rotate that. So, you know, like getting down into a deep squat position, some lunging position, like Greg said, the upper back. Just pick one thing that you're going to really throw some volume at that movement and tackle it for a week, and then kind of rotate through those elements, and you'll definitely make some good progress on that. And standard good nutrition is going to help all that. Not being inflamed is going to encourage the tissues to remodel. Cool.
Totally cool. All right. So this next question is interesting to me, because I've always wanted to hear someone with a really good propeller hat like Rob answer, because I have my thoughts on it, but they're definitely unscientific, to say the least. Matt says, do compression garments like skins really increase performance and reduce recovery time? If so, how?
Well,
you want me to start off and then you can tell me why I'm wrong?
Yeah, you kick this one off. I'll see where you want to go.
First of all, I mean, compression stuff with the popularity of CrossFit have suddenly really come to the forefront. But I remember back in the olden days, in my misguided youth, when I was kind of involved in the cycling world. And no, I was not a distance cyclist. I rode competitive trials, so shut up. But I did deal with a lot of distance cyclists, and compression shorts, I mean, they were like an everyday thing back then. It was old news to cyclists. And the biggest thing I remember being told was that they really reduced the amount of vibration in the muscles, you know, that you would get from sitting in the saddle and bouncing around the road. And this was supposed to reduce fatigue. And I think I read something about, you know, it helped keep your muscle fibers like better aligned or something like that. Although I really don't see how muscle fibers can get misaligned from bouncing around. But
right.
In any case, you know, I was always somewhat skeptical, and I never really thought there would be – if there was any kind of performance increase or recovery increase, it really wouldn't be – it would be negligible. And so, you know, it was never really interesting to me. But a good friend of ours, Ben Kelly, who owns CrossFit Performance out in Connecticut?
I forget. Hampshire?
Yeah, I think it's Connecticut.
Connecticut,
somewhere.
Yeah,
I tried to fly there one time, and you had to take like 18 planes and then a canoe just to get there. But in any case, if you're in that area, you should definitely go train with him. And he is a rep for Body Science, who makes compression gear. It's I think they're based out of Australia. But anyway, he sent Amy a couple pairs. I have a pair of the shorts. Amy loves them. She'll train in them sometimes, but mainly we use them in between training as kind of a recovery deal. And honestly, I slept in mine last night. And I've experimented with that for the last month or so, and I honestly don't really I think they help. They help get my legs recovered. Now, my one gripe about them is that these particular ones don't fit me quite right. I have fairly well-developed glutes. And so, you know, the leg portion fits well, but it's like they're like lowrider jeans. And so they're definitely not something I would like cruise around in public with. But I do sometimes train in Under Armour compression shorts. I wear regular shorts over them. Don't get too excited. And I think it helps, honestly. And whether it's placebo or not, it doesn't really matter. The whole placebo effect, who gives a shit if it's a placebo effect? If it helps, it helps. And I don't really care why. Right. So I would say, yeah, if you have a few bucks to throw around, I think they're like 100+ bucks or something like that. Try it out. You know, it certainly isn't going to hurt anything. And you may find that you like them. And, I don't know anything about skins in particular. I've only used the Body Science ones, but check it out.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense in that, part of the whole circulatory issue is this venous return. And for venous return, typically, particularly out of the lower body while we're standing up or moving around, you need muscular contraction to force the blood through the valves and it pushes it back to the heart. And if you've got some sort of a compression garment on, that little bit of pressure is actually just slightly, both the lymph and the venous return is going to be improved to some degree. You see this taken to an extreme feature in the compression pants that pilots will wear, because when they're doing some sort of a banking turn, then the computer will sense that the pilot's being subjected to G-force. That G-force will pull the fluid column that's inside the pilot's body down into the lower extremities, and you can black the person out. And so you can improve the ability for the person to withstand G-force by, these pants literally inflating. But this is orders of magnitude different. What we're talking about with the compression garments is just a very subtle compression force that's essentially pushing, venous return back up into the upper body. Or if we're talking about wearing like a rash guard kind of thing, then it's going to do the same deal for the upper body. I think also to some degree, you're just getting a little bit of proprioceptive element. Just you're getting some feedback loop between the brain and the body part that you're wearing that compression gear. And I think it does something a little bit, tonifying it for the whole scenario. It seems like when people wear them, they like them. And they, when they don't wear them, they seem to notice not being quite as comfortable. I know when I was O-lifting a lot more, I would wear some just knee sleeves. And there certainly, it wasn't like when I was powerlifting where I had like this triple ply ace bandage kind of gig that was, adding 5% to my squat total. It was simply just kind of this warmth and this comfort and a little bit of proprioception to keep my old creaky knees moving a little bit better. So I think that there's a little bit of neurological proprioception and then a very mild kind of venous lymphatic return that gets improved with the compression gear.
Yeah, that sounds good. And plus, they're supposed to help if you have to sit on your butt all day long. They're supposed to help prevent DVTs, which is probably a good thing.
Huh. I should have been driving in those while I was sitting for 15 hours. My 940-mile driving day coming out to Santa Fe, that would have been nice.
Yes. Also, what you need, this is what Steve and I are working on right now, is have you seen those ice packs from Rite Aid? They're called Peas. So it's a bunch of like basically fake peas, these frozen little balls. So it's a nice malleable ice pack. But we want to make a beanbag chair full of those things. So you need to get one of those seat covers for your car made of that. It's going to be great.
Cool. And then I just need like some sort of cryo cryopack thing with like the tub of ice in the back and then pumping some fresh cold liquid through the whole thing.
Exactly. Get some game readies for your drive.
Cool.
All right. Let's do a business question.
Cool.
Which is going to be funny because I don't know that either Rob or I are very well versed in business, remarkably enough.
We'll reference my wife. So
seriously. All right. Jake says, "Hi, Rob and Greg. To get the fan business out of the way first, thank you both for the information you provide. From creating the performance menu back in the day to writing your books and producing the podcast nowadays, the information you both have made available is absolutely worth your combined weights in gold 100 times over. That seems unfair because I weigh like twice as much as Rob. And if that is not confusing enough, I am salivating for the second chapter or the mechanistic biomolecular presentation that was cleverly and excruciatingly hinted at during your presentation to the CSU Anthropology Forum." I love that, the second chapter. "I was wondering if you would be able to spend some time on the podcast talking about the business side of opening a gym. I'm chained to a desk at the moment trying to save the startup capital while my wife finishes her Doctor of Physical Therapy degree. At the moment, with another 6 months left on my contract, it does not seem like starting a gym is a very wise thing to do. So getting to the questions, yes, this gets longer. 1, what was the beginning of NorCal S&C / Catalyst Athletics like? did you have a set amount of startup capital that you wanted to have before you took the plunge? What type of liability insurance do you go with? Rob, do you use the NSCA CSCS insurance? Did you float for a while without insurance? And lastly, were there issues that arose for which you had not planned?" Of course not. "Or was there a large element of fly by the seat of your pants and address issues as they present themselves? Just wanted to get this topic out there, and I understand if you do not want to cover it in the podcast. As I typed the questions, I had a sense that they were akin to asking both questions as to your personal, financial, and insurance situations. Any advice you both could share either on the podcast or through email would be greatly appreciated."
Well, you know, throwing this out there, I know that there are a lot of gym owners and trainers. Like, Nikki literally is the whiz on this. So if folks are interested, we could certainly do a podcast that has Nikki come on for a round of questions, and we could make it kind of the you know, how to do business, starting a gym, you know.
I think that would
all
be
that
good
stuff. So if folks are interested in that, let us know. Nikki is outstanding on this. Her background was economics, and in addition to like Russian and Italian. So she can describe developing a business to you in like 6 different languages.
And the collapse of the former Soviet Union.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So what was the beginning of NorCal strength and conditioning? We started off.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, it was amazing. We started off in the back of a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu kickboxing school. John Frankel, who's one of the most amazing guys I've ever known, a PhD from Harvard in Korean literature, black belt in jits. He got his either blue or purple belt from Hickson. He's got a great Thai boxing game. He's certified under Dan Inosano in Filipino martial arts and JKD. And I was introduced to him actually from Greg Glassman via email, because I was living up in Seattle. We had opened CrossFit North with Dave Warner and Nick Nibbler and myself, but I really wanted to get back down in the sun and kind of had this opportunity to get back down to Chico where I did my undergrad. And so we started off in the back of the gym, and then it wasn't too long after we opened, maybe 5 months, 6 months, that John decided to take a position at the University of Seoul in Korea. And so he left, and the whole scene was a little bit dodgy after he left, and with regards to our interface with the MMA element of the building that we were in. And also we were growing reasonably quickly and decided to move. But I mean, we started just startup capital. I mean, it was less than $3,000 in gear. It was very, very nominal. That's one thing that I would recommend to folks is tackle this stuff in a very piecemeal fashion if you need to, you know, have a plan, but tackle it in a piecemeal fashion. Nikki has done a ton of consulting with people who went in great guns, but had no business systems, had no idea how to manage or structure anything. And people have lost their houses. People have you know, had really gnarly stuff go down because they didn't stay within their means. And That's a big element. And even before that, I would really ask a question like, do you really like being with people every day? Like, do you like coaching? Do you like hand-holding? We've had people come out of, corporate gigs and stuff like that, and they love the idea of coaching. They love reading blogs and doing all that sort of jive. But then the day-to-day chop wood, carry water, dealing with people wasn't what they wanted to do. Like, they expected to tell people, hey, ass back, chest up on your squat, and you tell them once, and then your job's done. But in fact, you tell that person 10,000 times, and you still are excited about it. I would recommend that people check out something like a Myers-Briggs personality test. And if you end up being on the introverted side of the Myers-Briggs, I would really, really ask a hard question about whether or not running a gym and being a coach is a smart option for you. Just because the need to be on and the having people in your face all the time, like Greg is a great coach. My wife is a phenomenal coach, but I would put both you guys probably energy wise more on the introvert side. And it's not that they're not outgoing. Some people kind of gain energy from working within themselves and working on personal projects. Other people like me love being in the middle of a group of people. I love being kind of the center of attention and being like the, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey circus kind of thing going on. And I dig that. Like, I am energized from that scenario. Whereas like Nikki can do that and she is exhausted after that scene. So I would really ask a question like, who are you and what spins your propeller? And if you like doing, quiet introspective work, if you're going to open a gym, I would make sure that you've got some help so that you're not 100% the person on the floor running all that stuff. Like that's just a huge piece. Your great thoughts on that stuff up till here?
Yeah. I mean, the beginning of Catalyst was probably a lot different than your typical gym. So I don't think that it's probably a good example for a new endeavor, because when we opened this facility, Catalyst Athletics and the Performance Menu had already been around for a few years. Mm-hmm. And so we came into it, I already had a pretty good reputation. People knew who I was. They knew the place was coming. And so by the time we opened, we had people already kind of lined up wanting to train. And now that's not to say that we were flooded with clients, but it required essentially zero promotion to get going. And so, I think for your typical person, like that, the biggest thing you need to plan for is one, understand that you're going to end up spending way more money than you plan for. And two, you're going to have to work way harder to get clients than you expect. And yeah. So go into it, I don't want to say pessimistically, but very cautiously, and basically overestimate all of your expenses and way underestimate your projections for incoming clientele. You know what I mean? Right. Figure out, get the operating expenses for a good 6 months, figuring that you don't have enough clients to actually cover your overhead. You know what I mean? Have that cushion, because if you go in there saying, okay, we have enough money to pay rent and utilities for 2 months, and then after that, we're going to need 90 clients to stay afloat, probably not a good idea. Especially these days, if you're going into it more of a CrossFit business, I can stand on the roof of this gym, throw a rock, and hit about 18 CrossFit gyms. I mean, like the market is absolutely saturated, and there's a new one opening every month. So it's not like, when NorCal opened, it was the only gig in town. And
well, we were the fourth gym in the world that was running the CrossFit banner. And now we've been to towns that have fewer than 40,000 people population, and they have five gyms in town.
Yeah, it's crazy. So you really can't rely just on that to bring you clientele. And the issue now is that, there are so many CrossFit gyms that people are attending them for reasons of convenience rather than quality of programming or coaching. So in other words, hey, I want to do CrossFit. There's one right across the street from where I work. I'm going to go there. Rather than, hey, I want to do CrossFit. I've heard these guys are really good. These guys are twats. So I'm going to drive an extra 10 minutes. It's just not working like that from what I can tell. And so you really need to plan and pay attention like any other business would about you know, what is the market actually going to support? You know, check out the area, do your homework there, and just don't expect CrossFit or any other banner to magically produce clients for you.
Right. And you know what, it would really be good to get Nikki on the podcast and talk about some of this stuff. What liability insurance do we go with? I forget the name that we use, but ours is very comprehensive, and we go additionally, we have some line item inclusions for gymnastics gear that is used for strength and conditioning purposes. So we, it's funny, there was a really old affiliate gathering back when there were 35 affiliates, and this is probably, 2006, and we were at this gig, and both Dave Warner and myself raised the issue that if somebody fell off a set of rings, if somebody was doing some pass-throughs on a pommel horse, that you could face the potential of your liability insurance being made null and void because the injury occurred on gymnastics equipment, and most strength and conditioning, fitness-oriented stuff, there's a line item exclusion saying, you know, does not cover gymnastics. And the response from the powers that be at that time was, we don't teach gymnastics, wink, wink, nod, nod. And that was the foresight that they brought to bear on this situation. And we were like, that's absolutely ridiculous. And so we have always run with 10 times more liability insurance, facility insurance, line item inclusions for the different things that we offer. And so like you really shouldn't need to create, this is just a whole sideline kind of political jab, I guess, but an RRG is what you use for people who like, you know, jump out of airplanes after they've thrown a parachute out of the airplane and then they have to go and like catch it. Like it's for stuff that's like uninsurable and it's just ridiculous. What we do is generally pretty safe. You just have to not burn bridges with insurers and not conduct yourself like an idiot. But we just are insured to the hilt. I let my NSCA stuff go a while back, not out of any like political things or anything one way or the other. But we've just researched the heck out of our insurance. And actually, my wife would probably shoot me if I tell people who we've gone through. So that's going to end up remaining a little bit of a secret. But I'll just say this, that we have included gymnastics gear in a line item fashion and stuff like that so that we're covered even in that eventuality.
Yeah, we've got pretty extensive insurance. I mean, we have a facility policy that's pretty inclusive of everything we do. We don't get too jiggy on anything that could be even considered gymnastics. I mean, to be honest, I haven't even seen a muscle up in this gym in months. We just don't mm-hmm. we don't get goofy with that stuff. But aside from that facility policy, you know, me personally, I have two policies on myself. I have one as, you know, a fitness trainer, even though I don't really do that anymore. But then I have a second one that covers me as the coach of a competitive team. And so it was really interesting when I was looking for insurance, those two things, no one was really willing to cover both. You know, they wanted to separate that stuff, which is fine with me. And you know, actually as a weightlifting coach, USA Weightlifting provides some degree of insurance for lifters who are USA Weightlifting members, but not everyone who trains here with the weightlifting team is a USA Weightlifting member, even though, you know, 90% of them are. I just don't want to have to worry about that stuff. And I still have my CSCS and I don't deal with that insurance. I'd rather just have insurance that is separate. I know exactly what's going on. And I don't want to do that much reading. So, you know, once it's in place, I just kind of leave it there. And then like Rob said, I try not to be an idiot and hurt people.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I don't mean that to be super rude, but because things do happen, you know, accidents happen. You know, like I said, do your best to not be stupid, put your clients in situations that are unnecessarily dangerous, because as Rob said, strength and conditioning shouldn't be dangerous. There's certainly no element of it that warrants an RRG. That's just retarded. But you do have to be prepared for the eventuality that if you're training enough people for a long enough time, somebody is going to get hurt. That's just probability. Be careful about what exactly you're doing and whether or not your insurance covers it. Because a lot of times, exactly what you need is not covered.
Yeah, like we used to offer a kickboxing class on Fridays, and then kind of interest waned.
Fights on Fridays.
Fights on Fridays. And we had a line item inclusion for martial arts training. And then when that went away, we let that one go. So you have to research it a little bit, because people will be like, oh, you know, I'm just going to hold some mitts for somebody. But the person tweaks an ankle. God, you know, I mean, rips a bicep tendon because of a bad uppercut or something like that. And then they go to the doctor and they're like, well, I was at a boxing class. And then when the insurance adjuster asked, you know, questions, it's like, well, it wasn't a class. I just held pads for her today. And it's like, well, it was martial arts training and you're not covered for that. So you need to cover your fanny a little bit. It would be nice to live somewhere where, you know, it wasn't hyper litigious and you didn't have to worry about this stuff, that people just took some personal accountability. But you know, if you live in North America, that's not the case at all. This is a good question. Were there issues that arose for which you had not planned? Nothing that we planned for went the way that we expected. Starting the gym in Chico, California. Chico's kind of a quirky little town. If you cruise around at all, you'll see people who have bumper stickers, and the bumper stickers say, Chico is my hometown. And the vibe that you get is that if you are new, you can go pound sand. And so we were in town for a long time, really trying to get clients. And it was a slow go the first couple of years. We made loose friends with people at the rock climbing supply place in town. And it was really interesting. There was a Rock and Ice magazine piece that was featuring Mark Twight. And I was like, oh, dude, you know, like I was just on the phone with Mark like earlier. This was like 2005, maybe like right before the big Golden Colorado sort of Palooza gig that went down at the Colorado State Police. But I'm talking to this guy and they're offering like Mark Twight's book and a magazine that he's featured in and gear. And I was like, hey, man, we've got ropes and cargo nets and backer ladders and all this stuff. Come out and check it out. These guys wouldn't even come to the gym, not even for our holiday parties. So Chico was really weird in that regard. And so now the gym is pretty darn successful. We have like an 8-person staff. People pretty much have as busy a schedule as they want. But it wasn't always that way. But what's interesting is it was so hard to get our gym going that now the business systems that we have, like Nikki will do consulting with somebody. And if they live in a fairly dense urban population area, if they will do the things that she tells them, you know, like a beginner's class and the way that she structures the payment of trainers and different things, typically people end up growing shockingly fast because our business systems are robust enough. It's kind of like if it will grow in Chico, it will grow anywhere. And so that was something that we definitely didn't plan for, was the need for business systems and the need for planning and really the need for projections. Nikki has received these things from folks who were cooking up new ways of like incentivizing people to sign up and stuff like that. And it looked really cool on paper. And Nikki would plug it into her spreadsheet where she would do projections, profit and loss projections, and how you pay yourself and the bills and all this sort of jive. And this methodology that this guy shipped to her, and it was interesting because it had a number of CrossFit HQ on the email thread saying, this looks great. And what this thing did was in the first 6 months, you made a little bit of money. In the second 6 months, you made very much less money. You had a gym full of people. But then years 2, 3, and 4, you started bleeding money the way that this guy had structured this thing. But unless you did a projection that mapped it out and, you know, beyond a year into the future, you would never know that. But this is the thing to wrap your head around. You've got a gym full of paying customers and you would be bleeding money.
That seems like a problem.
That to me, that becomes a problem. And there are a ton of people out there with that, because there's no infrastructure. It's largely the blind leading the blind. Like when I think about people who've done pretty well in kind of the CrossFit micro gym scene, OPT James Fitzgerald kind of comes to mind because he interned right under Charles Poliquin, and Charles has some very robust business systems. You know, personal training being the primary element, the group class stuff is what James has developed later. But if you're just in there making this stuff up on your own and you don't have beginner's classes and all the rest of that, man, it's a tough road to hoe. You're gonna have a lot of problems by having people not stick around, having high attrition, all that sort of jive. So I guess maybe that's as much as we'll hammer on the business side of that. But again, if people are interested in that, we can get Nikki on the show and we can talk bid and ask sometime.
Yes. But yeah, probably the basic advice comes down to have a really good plan, know that you really want to do it, and then get some money. Kind of your basics and right there.
Stay within your means.
Yeah.
Like grow at a pace that feels comfortable for you and that isn't going to, you know, cause you to lose your house or something wacky like that.
Yes. Okay.
Almost there. Almost done.
Couple quick ones. These will be good ones.
Yeah.
Kathy says, "Hi, Rob. Love your book." That's 2 exclamation marks. I'm working on the sleeping in complete darkness thing. I have no electronics in the bedroom, and I've ordered blackout curtains since I live in a fairly high-density area with some light from streetlights and neighbors to contend with. But here's the thing. I don't like complete darkness, and I can't help but wonder about the hunter/gatherer ancestors. Surely there was some moonlight and starlight that found its way into their shelters. Are we really mimicking their lifestyle by having no light whatsoever? I'm not trying to be cantankerous, whiny maybe. I really do want to know about this. Thanks."
So this is a question that pops up frequently. And if you look at Wikipedia, actually has a pretty good page on this where you look at the relative intensities of light that we can get out of the environment, you know, like sunlight versus, direct sunlight versus morning indirect sun versus, office lighting. What we find is that the intensity of moonlight and starlight are orders of magnitude less than what we get from office or just home lighting. There's this thing called the inverse square law, where the closer a light source or an energy source is, you know, the energy density increases by a square. Every increment that you have the distance closer, it increases the intensity of the energy being brought onto a surface by 4 times or the square of it. So what we have is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, our office lighting is relatively low intensity, but it's very, very close to us. So the amount of light that we receive is far, far greater than what we would normally get. And this is all assuming, you know, after hours photo exposure. So if we were going to bed when the sun went down and getting up when the sun went up, and we had a little bit of low-level light that was mimicking that which we saw from starlight or moonlight, then we probably wouldn't see the problems associated with like metabolic derangement and insulin resistance and stuff like that. But we don't. We stay up watching TV, and our photo exposure is much different than what the ancestral light exposure was. So that's kind of the long and short of it. And that completely dark room, what it's trying to do is offset the little niggling bit of photo exposure that we still get because we don't go to bed when the sun goes down and get up when the sun gets up. So that's the stuff. And the thing that I largely hang my hat on with that is, you know, the continuing bolus of studies that we get about photo exposure and metabolic problems, insulin resistance primarily. And then also just the observation that when people actually tackle this in a concerted way, that they look, feel, and perform better. Typically they lean out, the recovery is better, all that sort of jive.
Yeah, I like it.
So don't be afraid of the dark.
Yeah. Well, the problem is if you have a dog or something that sleeps in your room and then you walk on its head when you're trying to get to the bathroom in the middle of the night. So you got to shuffle.
That's what a spare bedroom is for.
For you or the dog?
For the dog. Possibly you.
All right. Last one. Nick says, "I'm having a difficult time getting my shins together for Muay Thai. What diet/training can you recommend, please? Thanks for sticking up the blog. I'm absolutely a fan."
Oh, man.
Kick people.
Really? Yeah, kick people. You know, standard paleo shtick, so your recovery is good. But when I was Thai boxing, like, I did a ridiculous amount of shin conditioning. I was doing a lot of Kali and Eskrima at the same time, so I had rattan sticks around, and I would just beat on my shins. And I mean, this is probably not medically sound. There's probably some orthopedic dangers here, so, you know, buyer beware on this. But I basically for about 4 years was walking around with chronically bruised shins. But when I fought, I only had six amateur fights. Two of them actually kind of professional rules where I didn't have the shin guards on and all that stuff. But my shins were really well conditioned because I would just constantly tap, tap, tapping with rattan sticks, the Coke bottle deal a la, you know, straight up Thai boxing camp and all that stuff. You just have to be kind of incremental. They're in a constant state of soreness. Whenever you bump them against something, they hurt. But that's just kind of what you do. I mean, it's Thai boxing, so it's not comfortable. But the you know, good food, good nutrition, and then just keeping your shins roughed up, and then really laying off of that before a fight, so that they can kind of recover and super compensate a little bit. But otherwise, you're just kind of cruising around with a low grade, you know, bone bruise all the time, and you have to use smart application of your shin guards during your training so that, you know, you can still get some good kind of live sparring and also some really good pad work. But if you're so chewed up on your shins that stuff hurts, such that you start pulling kicks and you start changing your mechanics because of fear of clanging a sore spot, and you've got to factor all that stuff in.
Yeah, I prefer the I remember if it's kickboxer or blood sport method where you just kick
the banana tree.
You just kick the post in the basement until you shake all the plaster loose.
That,
definitely kick it on the corner though, not the flat part.
It'll
work much quicker. So good luck with that.
So I think that's episode 79, and we went a little long, but folks can, well, I don't know. I could just turn it off, I guess.
I think it was a relatively entertaining one. But maybe it was just all the caffeine I had in me. I don't know.
Well, I'm just happy that it's sunny. You know, weather forecast in Santa Fe, sunny.
Well, you know what? I got to say that your new place now, it's going to be the perfect cult compound.
It's what we're looking for.
I mean, you got out in the desert, you got a little bit of acreage. It's going to be amazing.
The Kool-Aid shipment is arriving soon, so
Excellent.
We'll be set. Yeah.
Cool.
All right, G. I think that's it, at least for this week.
Yeah, I'm going to go lift some weights.
Cool, dude. Thanks,
All
man.
All right, see ya.
Okay, bye.